It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you are not a comic book store regular, you might be shocked at the incredible variety of titles available in your local comic book shop. The characters we all know about from the Marvel and DC universes are there, along with superheroes, detectives, vigilantes, journalists, and characters from many different walks of life. Later this hour, we'll talk about the scope of this world with comic book artist and writer Phil Hester, who has worked on Batman, Wonder Woman, Ant-Man, and many others. But first, we'll explore the role of African-American women in comics on the page as characters and as writers and artists. Deborah Elizabeth Whaley is author of Black Women in Sequence, Re-Inking Comics, Graphic Novels, and Anime. She's also an associate professor of American Studies and African-American Studies at the University of Iowa. Deborah, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go back to your beginning with comic books. When did you first start reading them?
I started reading comic books at a young age, I think, like most of our listeners, and like most that read comic books, it starts, you know, when you're a child, becomes this way to get excited about reading, and that certainly was the case for me. So I would say elementary school. I don't know if I could name a particular age, but I know it was definitely elementary school. And I loved to read comic books. I loved to draw comics and replicate the images that I would see in comic books. I liked to read comic strips, especially in the newspaper. The funny section, again, like a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, and people who read the newspapers or even children, the comic section or the funny pages, as it's so often called, was that entree into the world of sequential art for many.
Absolutely. Now, what titles got you excited when you were a kid?
Lots of different titles. So insofar as comics were concerned, I love the comic strip Kathy, which was this comic strip that I read in the 1980s when I was a kid about this young female independent protagonist who had interactions with, you know, different boyfriends and her job, and had a really sort of funny take on relationships and work and all of that. It might have been just a tad bit advanced for me in terms of my age, but I loved it. There was another wonderful comic strip called Jumpstart that I liked that had an African-American couple. The male protagonist was a police officer. The woman protagonist was a nurse. They had this nuclear family, and it was about the trials and tribulations of raising children in everyday life. But in terms of comics and graphic novels, like many, I loved the superhero comics. I loved Wonder Woman. All of the major male superheroes I was mesmerized by and had crushes on, right? So Superman, Batman, especially Spider-Man, because he was sort of that everyday superhero, regular guy who ended up having magical powers that I think a lot of people could relate to because of his normalness, but yet his grandness when he became Spider-Man.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
I grew up mostly in California. I'm from Colorado, a suburb of Denver called Wheat Ridge. So I generally just say I'm from Denver, but mostly raised in California in the Bay Area in San Jose.
Now, you are already sort of bucking the stereotype of a comic book fan, because the immediate stereotype is a man or a guy.
Right.
And then further stereotypes would say it's a white guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're an African-American woman. As an African-American girl reading these comic strips, now you mentioned Jumpstart. Of course, you did get to see African-American people on the page, but you didn't see a lot of people that looked like you. Did that bother you? Did you think about that when you were reading them as a kid?
I didn't think about it as a child consciously. And it's such an interesting question to ask, because a lot of the discussions in the fan world on podcasts or on social media or even the social criticism talks about this issue of people of color being put in the position to relate to white superheroes growing up? And what does that mean psychologically? What does that mean socially? So it really wasn't until later that I would be exposed to some of the black characters, whether they came through animation or even television, like the show Batman. I mentioned in my book in the preface how exciting it was as a young child to watch reruns of Batman and see Eartha Kitt embody Catwoman. And that was really a special moment. And at that time, because again, I was a child, I don't know that I articulated in a way of, oh, here's a black image, you know, that I can connect to, but I connected to it. So I think that really does sort of point to the importance of having diverse representations, which I take up in the book. And it's great that we're in a moment now where if you were to ask someone, so I'm in my 40s, I won't say the exact age, but I think if you were to ask someone this question who was maybe 25, they could have a different answer for you insofar as having the opportunity to read, see more characters of color and what that was like for them. And I would assume really empowering, just as I felt about the character Catwoman as played by Eartha Kitt on television.
You, for the research in this book, you must have spent many, 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 many hours going through archives and learning about different genres and different artists and different writers over the years. What was it that gave you that spark that made you think, I'm going to get very serious about doing all of this research and looking back through all of this history? What made you want to find, and really in many ways, every African-American woman who was a character, who was a writer, who was an artist in this world? What was that spark?
Well, I think it came from two places. So we were talking about early characters that I related to, even though there were not a lot. I did like Storm and X-Men, right? So she was part of a collective. She wasn't largely featured like she has been, I would say, over the past couple decades in her own graphic novel and then in the X-Men films, especially the third installment where she had sort of a larger portrayal and screen time. So wanting the opportunity to talk about these characters and these creators that really have had no scholarly treatment or very little scholarly treatment. So I thought having the opportunity to talk about characters like Storm, who were leaders, who have moral complexity. My interest, again, in the character Catwoman from television and the film from 2004 with Halle Berry that nobody liked. and so it was especially after 2004. So, you know, I grew up reading comics, loved drawing comics, took cartooning, did some training in cartooning. And so as an artist, I've always connected to comics in terms of the visual image, but I've written lots of different things, and I never thought at any moment during all the other things I've written about to really write about comics until around 2004, after I saw the film Catwoman and I had seen these representations from X-Men, also played by Halle Berry in her rendition of Storm. And I thought, you know, this is a really interesting moment. Now we have had two representations of black female comic characters, both ironically portrayed by Halle Berry,
the same actress,
on the big screen. And it might be a good moment to sort of take stock about what this means. So it really started with an article on the film Catwoman. And then I found that I needed to go back and read all of the Batman comic books, all of the Catwoman graphic novels, and really look at the character over the years. And as I was doing my research, I found that there was really little, again, written about Black women in comics as readers, as characters, and as creators. So I saw it as a real opportunity to fill that gap and to have the opportunity to merge my artistic sensibilities with my scholarly sensibilities, right, which I really had not had the opportunity to do much of.
Now, and you cite a number of different works about African-American men in comics. That is an area that maybe not widely explored, but certainly there had been some scholarly research done and a number of different books published on African-American men as characters and artists. You went back to find African-American women, and what the first character of African descent was in 1934, and that was a male character. There were a few others. The first Black superhero was the Black Panther of Marvel in 1966. When did you find a woman in an African-American woman in comic books?
So I begin the book talking about the butterfly, who is cited as the first Black female superhero in an independent title called The Butterfly. But she also appeared in Hellrider. And I sort of begin the book there and talking about the meaning of the character. You know, she had the power of a butterfly. She could cast light from her eyes that would blind to stop villains. She was a singer and she was this vigilante. And it was a really sort of fun early 1970s representation. Well, she only lasted two issues.
Wow.
So she kind of disappeared from the comic book world. But after the butterfly, we would have African characters who would come about and characters who their genealogy or their place of origin was sort of unsure or unknown or ambiguous, right? So in Wonder Woman in the early 1970s, we have Nubia, who is the Black Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman's sister.
Right.
And there's a little of some uncertainty. Is she from Paradise Island or is she from Africa?
Right. Well, we'll
We're
have
not
to pick
sure.
that
yeah.
up after the break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is Deborah Elizabeth Whaley. She's the author of Black Women in Sequence, Reinking Comics, Graphic Novels, and Anime. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about comic books. And coming up in a little while, we're going to try to get some insight into how vast the universe of comic books has become with comic book artist and writer Phil Hester. With me now is Deborah Elizabeth Whaley. She's the author of Black Women in Sequence, Reinking Comics, Graphic Novels, and Anime. She's also Associate Professor of American Studies and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. And Deborah, just before the break, we were talking about some of the characters that you went back and found in your research looking for African-American or African women of African descent in comic books. I want to go back to a really groundbreaking artist that you write about in your book, a woman that I will admit that I had never heard of. But tell us a little bit about Jackie Zelda Ormes. She was such a trailblazer.
She was absolutely a trailblazer for women in comics in general, especially women doing comic strips, but again, more generally, just women creators in the world of sequential art. So Jackie Ormes did work in Black newspapers like the Chicago Tribune and the Pittsburgh Courier. She did three comic strips throughout her life. One was Candy, which she did in the 1940s. She's probably most well known for her 1930s comic strip, Torchy Brown, which she picked up again later in the 1950s. And then her third comic strip was Patty Joe and Ginger.
And she was also a journalist.
She was.
So the fact that here she is, a woman in the 1930s, as a journalist, also publishing comic strips, that's really out there. That's incredibly unusual. And then the fact that she was an African-American woman doing that, again, I mean, she had to be one of the very few.
Absolutely. So she was breaking ground in many different ways as an activist, as a cartoonist, and as a newswoman. And interestingly enough, one of the things I talk about in the book, and there's a wonderful biography of Jackie Orms by Nancy Goldstein, who's a wonderful, very generous person who I spoke with while doing research for this book. And she was really, really helpful to me. The interesting thing about Orms is, so yes, she was a journalist. She did write on the news of the day, sometimes topics like fashion or sports or more sort of concrete news stories. But one of the things that the biography of Orms brings up is that there were moments where she sort of met a glass ceiling, like many women did who were doing journalistic work. And so there came a time where she came to the decision that she could write about the news of the day through comic strip form, and that would be allowable in a way that doing stories or other type of journalistic work that men would have first privy to in terms of the stories, she was able to report the news through the comic strip form. So interestingly enough, that glass ceiling or the roadblocks that she faced in journalism actually led to a career in cartooning as a cartoonist, still doing the news,
right,
but through the visual form.
Now, looking at her characters, she avoided a lot of the stereotypes of the day, the kinds of characters that are caricatures that you would see of African American women back in the 30s and 40s. And when you look at her characters, I mean, I see that they're beautiful. I see that they're smart. I see that they have a really clear vision of the world around them and can convey that to the reader. What do you see?
I see those very same things. And again, we are talking about the late 1930s, right? Whereas you say, there were erroneous depictions of blackness just more generally for men and women, adults and children in the media if they were represented at all. So to have Orms create these comic strips that were really antithetical to how blackness was being conceived in the public sphere was really amazing to see. And she really does stand out as one of those early people to depict blackness in a multifaceted way. Now, that being said, you're absolutely right. She had characters who were smart and attractive, mostly middle class, although her character Candy, that she wrote in the 1940s, worked as a domestic, maid domestic, so working class. But most of her characters were middle class. At that time, that was a really groundbreaking representation to depict black women in these middle class spaces where they did not always have entry to in real life in the public sphere. And these women were talking about politics. They were talking about class, her characters, right? They were talking about the economic depression. And they were also talking about fun things like love and courtship, their family circles. So her characters were really multifaceted in so many ways, bridging the social and cultural and political together.
She was a little subversive in what she wrote, maybe a lot subversive in what she wrote. Some of the comic strips that you include in your book have commentary on segregation, et cetera. And the fact that she was publishing these somewhat subversive comic strips did not go unnoticed by the U.S. government. So the FBI started watching her. What was their concern?
Absolutely. So she was writing these in black newspapers. So the circulation in many ways was limited to the black public sphere, not to say that only black people read black newspapers. But she did, the government did take notice. Looking at her FBI file, they do not directly reference her comic strips. But I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that the types of things that she was doing, because they were – the FBI was following her. They were tracking everything she did, all of her financial transactions, where she went, if she went to visit a bookstore in Chicago. You know, those types of things were in her FBI file. They were tracking everything she did. So although they did not directly reference her comic strips, I do believe that the type of activism and insurgent voice she had about war, about segregation, about the ways in which people of African descent were being treated at the time was of concern for them. But her activism was of concern for them. And that's what they really talk about in her FBI file. So that she would frequent meetings of the Communist Party, that she had fleeting types of leadership roles in local organizations that were associated with the Communist Party, that she had friends that were associated with the Communist Party.
And of course, this was during a time when a lot of people were being watched and followed and
yes.
blacklisted. And
yes.
So what did that come to anything for her? Were there consequences?
There were consequences insofar as they were concerned enough to create this over 200-page file that, chronicles many, many, many years of surveillance. They did interview her twice, which I talk about in the book, and I excerpt out some of the FBI file where they're asking her questions about her loyalties to the U.S. And so did it affect her professionally? She still went on to do comic strips. She still went on to do work. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that she was doing this work in light of knowing that she was being surveillanced by the government and the stress of that. And there are moments or there are depictions in some of her comic strips where she sort of talks about the communist witch hunt of various writers and artists and actresses that was going on at the time. And I think that was sort of an indirect way to talk about herself as an artist being surveilled.
Right. I'm talking with Deborah Elizabeth Whaley. She's the author of the book Black Women in Sequence, Reinking Comics, Graphic Novels, and Anime. And we were just talking about the really incredible, groundbreaking work of Jackie Orms as an artist and a comic strip writer. What do you think her legacy has been? Is she someone that is well known among African American writers and artists today?
She absolutely is. So not too long ago, the Orms Society formed, which now, unfortunately, there's been somewhat of a proliferation of the organization. So it's not as intact as it once was when they started. But an organization called the Orms Society formed, which was a coalition of black female artists and writers. And so they used Orms' name as a namesake as a way to point to the beginning of black women in comics as writers and as artists, and to really pay tribute to Orms. So women working in the field today are absolutely aware of her. Even in some of the anthologies by women writing primarily about white female cartoonists, there have been a short mention of Orms. I'm thinking of Trina Robbins' amazing work. You know, she's an amazing cartoonist as well as a scholar of comics who's written several books. And she's mentioned Orms in some of her anthologies on women cartoonists. So she's not well known widely, but within the world of comics and sequential art, she is known.
Much earlier, before our first break today, we were talking about some of the different characters that have appeared in comic books over the years, different characters of African descent, African American women. We were talking about Nubia, who was in Wonder Woman, and she's the Black Wonder Woman in many ways. And we were talking about Catwoman as well, which you write a great deal about Catwoman. And Catwoman is many different ethnicities in many different incarnations. And of course, you mentioned the Halle Berry, you mentioned the Eartha Kitt. Why explore this character so much that is only Black sometimes?
That's a great question. Well, one of the interesting things about Catwoman is her racial fluidity. And I really wanted to look at characters who broke significant ground. And so when you ask someone, of the general population, what Black female comic book characters do you know? Many will give you a blank face, or they'll say Storm.
Right.
And then they'll probably reference Eartha Kitt's rendition of Catwoman. So I felt I really had to address the character. And once I started doing research, I mean, I've always had an affinity to the character and read the graphic novel Catwoman. But once I started doing research on the character, I really found her racial fluidity fascinating, and that while she is known primarily as a white sort of anti-heroine, anti-hero comic book character who is white or European American, however you want to phrase it, but based on, from my research, a Chinese character, later became a Black character, then metamorphosed into a Latina character, then Black again, and then white, and then Black. And there's this recent 2014 comic book, Eartha Kitt Femme Fatale, that I talk a bit about, that has the representation of Catwoman as Black. So I talk about the character not only because of the racial fluidity and that she's been known as a Black character at different historical moments, but also because the character is just so interesting. She's strong. She's witty. She's this fallible woman. She's sexy. She's just interesting in so many ways. And if you sort of take race out of the equation just for a moment, the character Catwoman, whether we're talking about the comic strip character in Batman, who had so many funny sort of sexually inferred references that she would make, or even the television show Batman, Lee Merriweather's version of Catwoman, or Julie Newmar, or one of the best versions of Catwoman, I think, was Michelle Pfeiffer in the Batman movie. These are really amazing representations of womanhood, I think, that are smart and complex and interesting. And we don't see female characters in the media in general, I think, that are as interesting as the Catwoman character has been over time. So to write about her in the book, I felt was a wonderful opportunity to talk about gender and race and racial fluidity and power and sexuality all in one space.
And we are nearly out of time. The time has gone so quickly. I want to read an email that we just got from Kristen. It says, "The Adventures of Moxie Girl is a comic that was developed by a 7-year-old African-American girl. I don't know if it's been published yet, but she won an award to develop her comic. And here's an excerpt from the description. Moxie Girl is an African-American girl who hates her hair and thinks it's ugly until she finds a magical shampoo that gives her superpowers and helps her in the fight against crime and illiteracy. As her local library is surrounded by the Council of Monsters, Moxie Girl heads off to save the day," which sounds like a whole lot of fun. But in the very short amount of time we have left, tell me just a couple of the artists that you are excited about today. Because as I mentioned, the world of comics has expanded so much, and opportunities for African-American women and African-American women who are excited about this art form, there are so much going on. So who are you reading now? Who should we be looking for?
I'm really excited about the work of Afua Richardson, who has done amazing work. She worked on a comic book called Genius, and she's also worked for some of the she's worked for Top Cow indie labels, but she's also worked for some of the major comic book companies. And so she doesn't just exclusively draw representations of Black women, but she's a wonderful artist who does amazing work and is really well sought out right now. Ashley Woods, who I talk about in the book, has a wonderful graphic novel, Millennia War, which is really interesting, a nice mix of science fiction, Afrofuturist narratives with multiracial, multicultural casts. I love the work of Nara Walker's sort of manga aesthetic. And there's just so many women I could list, but there are a lot of Black women. There is a critical mass of Black women artists and writers working today.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah Elizabeth Whaley is the author of Black Women in Sequence, Reinking Comics, Graphic Novels, and Anime. She's also Associate Professor of American Studies and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about comic books and graphic novels. And the world of comic books and graphic novels seems to be ever expanding. To help us understand this world, we've invited Phil Hester. He's a comic book artist and writer who lives in North English, Iowa, to give us some insight. He's worked on Wonder Woman, Superman Confidential, Nightwing, El Diablo, Batman Legends of the Dark Knight, so many other books, and many independent titles as well. And he's back with us today. Phil, thank you so much for coming
Charity.
Back.
Thanks for having me.
And I think we've talked about this before, but give us a little bit of background on your interest in comic books. When did you first start reading them and what drew you?
Oh, I started when I was kind of a nerdy little kid and living in small town Iowa and small town Oklahoma. And, you know, I felt connected to this larger world of superheroes. And it just seemed so like fun to be able to like go down to the grocery store, the convenience store every week and see what's new and sort of for a quarter or 35 cents, sort of open up a new world to myself, you know, for the afternoon. So, yeah, that's when I started when I was a kid. And then about age 12 or 13, I started, you know, I'd always been interested in drawing myself. And at 12 or 13, it dawned on me that like, oh, there are actual human beings that do this. And maybe I could be one of these human beings. And I started making my own comics for just myself and my friends at that age and just kept doing it all the way through high school and college and then tricked people into paying me for it.
Now, of course, anybody who visits a comic book shop or has bought one in recent years will know that 25 cents is not the going price for a comic book.
It was barely that when I was a kid. Right? Yeah. I would make myself out older than I even am. But yeah.
But you don't see comic books on the newsstand, and maybe you don't see newsstands anymore. But when did we first start seeing the world of comic books and graphic novels really expanding beyond Archie and some of the superheroes that we think about?
I think there was this sort of underground explosion like in the 60s, that sort of whole counterculture, you know, growth that went on at that time. And comics was a small part of that as well. And comics started to be sold in other places besides the newsstand then. It started to be sold in like head shops and, you know, bookstores and places like that. And that sort of showed comic book creators there were alternative avenues to getting your work out there and that you didn't have to do all these squeaky clean superheroes. You could do other kinds of stories. And I was lucky that when I was coming up, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles blew up. And they were a small, independent, black and white comic book. And they started this thing called the Black and White Explosion in the mid-80s, which was basically anybody with a credit card could, you know, become a comic book publisher. And all these little small kind of semi-underground, we called them street level at that time because they weren't legit like Marvel and DC, but they weren't dirty like underground comics.
Right.
But so all these sort of like new voices started springing up in the 80s. And that's when I was in college. And I actually started working in comics when I was in college on those sort of street level books. And it was a really exciting time. And it gave rise to all the voices that became mainstream voices. And a lot of this stuff even that we see like if you look at that the latest Captain America movie, Winter Soldier, largely based on the work of Ed Brubaker, a writer who got his start in that kind of on a book called Low Life, that was done in that sort of 80s, 90s black and white explosion time. So all those kind of outsider voices have become insider mainstream voices now.
As we're talking about the world of comic books and how very big it is, we'd love to hear from you as well. If there's a title that has really captured your imagination that is not one of the titles that everybody knows about, give us a call. Share it with us. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So as these titles, you know, people started being able to publish, this explosion in the 1980s. Did you see this comic book shop culture begin to rise where there was a place where you could go and see what was going on?
Yeah, that's when it sort of, you know, really took off. It's, you know, all over the United States was that sort of mid-80s period. And also, I have to say, Marvel and DC also at that time saw that growing, and they started to do books that were for direct, you know, limited distribution only. They made books that weren't for sale on the newsstand to sort of find that audience that was so dedicated that they would be willing to go to the comic book shop every week. And yeah, that's when that – and that's sort of when that comic book culture started to be born, because before it was sort of like science fiction culture's little brother, little sister, you know. Mm-hmm. But then when the comic shops began and people start to sort of congregate at the comic shops, that's when that culture and that sort of society of fans began. And that's sort of where the comic book convention culture grew out of too, which is, as everybody knows now, is just sort of this runaway phenomenon.
Right, right. Well, and you actually are going to be at the very first Cedar Rapids Comic Con.
Yeah, that's pretty smooth how
February.
I did that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Done.
Yeah. It's it's less than a month away, and it'll be Cedar Rapids' sort of first dedicated Comic-Con, and it'll be, I think, the 6th of February. Yeah, I think you said it. Yeah, and it'll be downtown at the DoubleTree.
Cool. So as this comic book shop culture grew, obviously a lot more people could find what they were looking for, and a lot more genres could get exposure. Do you feel like the barrier to entry got higher?
Oh.
As well for or what do you
lower,
think?
Way lower. Think? Yeah, because all of a sudden there were so many more publishers. And also because drawing comics is pretty hard. You know, you have to have a pretty advanced skill set. So the people that are really good at it sort of, as you know, they sort of took all the jobs at Marvel and DC. And all these new publishers sort of had to take people who weren't ready, like me. When I was, you know, I was not ready when I started in comics. I may not be ready now. I don't know.
I think a lot of people would argue with you
okay,
on that.
Okay, but when I started, I was definitely not ready. But there were so many publishers. They had to hire people like me. And it was cool because then you got to see people that had maybe a little more quirky styles or individual voices. And I think it led to sort of this proliferation of like really unique, interesting takes on not only comic books in general, but on the superheroes that we came to work on later.
Well, that is really interesting because if you think about the big comic books from Marvel and DC, there, of course, were many generations and have been many generations of artists that have drawn those comic books. And the look has changed, but there are the fundamentals that still harken back to the people who created those characters. So drawing for those big titles, do you feel like you're imitating somebody else, or do you feel like you're making a Phil Hester original?
No, I always feel like I'm doing my own thing. And that's sort of the beautiful thing about comics is there's not a ton of money at stake like there is in movies and television. So, like, they don't get bent out of shape if I come in and I draw Batman's ears a little bit longer than the last, you know, person drawing Batman. And, you know, an individual voice or a quirky talent is – a little, it's valued, you know, we don't worry about taking big chances on things like that. So yeah, everybody has sort of their Batman, you know, he's such a universally, you know, recognizable character that you can come in and mess with him and you can still tell it's Batman. So yeah. So we look for those strange voices to freshen those, you know, what could become old and worn out characters.
Or heaven forbid retired.
Yes. Yeah. No, everyone's 29 forever in comics.
Well, what about for readers? Do you think that the barriers to entry have changed for readers, because you don't pick up the comic book at the grocery store when you go with your mom or dad anymore.
Yeah, certainly. It's a lot different now. I mean, with the rise of like online services like Comixology, you don't have to go anywhere to get your comic books now. And a lot of great comic books right now are not distributed in print at all. They're web strips. And there is zero barrier between you and being a web cartoonist, which is beautiful, I think, because before you...
Although it's probably hard to get paid for
it. Oh, yeah. It's super hard to get paid for it. Yeah. I know people doing it that you'd assume were... Because they're popular, you'd assume they're making good living at it, and they're not really. So, yeah, it's hard to monetize. But at the same time, it's good to see all these voices that were not necessarily shut out before, but maybe there wasn't room for them. And now they don't have to wait around for anybody. They can just go do their thing. And it's great to see, especially like you were talking about in the last segments, women cartoonists now, you know, they don't have to wait for entry into this, what was previously a boys club. They just start making their own comics. I think the most popular cartoonist in North America right now is Raina Tegelmeyer. And she's never worked at Marvel in D.C.
She doesn't have to.
She's done these great sort of younger reader books called Smile and Drama.
Oh, yeah. We have those at my home. Yeah, I should have known her name.
They're huge. I think probably the funniest cartoonist working now is Kate Beaton. And she does a book called Hark, a Vagrant. That's a collection of her online strips. But they're online strips. She doesn't wait around for anybody. She doesn't wait around for a publisher or an editor. She just does them. And, you know, there's all these cool new pathways to success now that I think make comics more exciting than ever.
Now, for those of us who don't spend time in comic book shops, can you give us an idea of the array of genres that there are now? I mean, we know we've got the DC and Marvel, but even within that, there are so many different things going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, superheroes still dominate, of course. That's sort of the prime mover of the comic book business. But even inside of a place like DC, they have a wing called Vertigo that caters to older sort of college age readers and more sophisticated storylines and, you know, sometimes a little nastier. But, you know, it's there's the superhero, there's science fiction. Image Comics right now is the third biggest publisher. And sort of their ethos is everything but superheroes. And it's a great time to be not only a reader but a creator. It's sort of a second golden age, I think.
Why do you think it's so effective for you, for anybody, to tell a story in this way?
Because I'm going to get all weird on you, but I think because comics sort of represent the best of film in that they're visual and compelling visually, but also reading a comic book has that same sort of, you have that same sort of personal relationship that you have with a novel. So it hits this little sweet spot where you control the pace as a reader, but you also get that sort of that thrill of the visual information that you get from a film. So it's sort of like a film, but you're at the toggle switch, kind of, you know, speeding it up and slowing it down as you'd like. So it combines reading and watching, which I think is a really interesting place.
Now, I have interviewed a number of comic book writers and artists over the years, and I really enjoy graphic novels. I'm not a particularly visual person. Mm-hmm. I love words, and I just rip through them like really fast. And then I think, why aren't there more words? Can we
have more words? No, that's okay.
I mean, but how do you read one?
Well, ideally, you don't know how you're reading one. If you're in the hands of a really great cartoonist, you don't realize you're going fast or slow. You're taking in everything as it sort of pours into your eyes. And, you know, but like you said, if you're not a visual person and you like the wordplay, you can tear through it. But if you're somebody like me who is interested, I'm like, oh, wow, look at the way they drew that rib cage on that character. You know, I can slow down and sort of savor it as well.
And when you write a comic book, I can imagine it that the writing is more like writing a screenplay.
Pretty much exactly like writing a screenplay, yeah.
So you're describing what the pictures should look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it depends on what kind of relationship you have with your artist, or if you're the artist. You change that, you know, as you go.
You have done writing. You have done the drawing part of this. Do you often combine both?
Yeah, I'd love to be able to write and draw everything I do. But it just depends on how different publishers see me. Some see me as a writer, some see me as an artist, and I'm okay with that. You know, that's great. I love doing both. So, and right now I'm pretty much 50-50.
And what are you working on right now?
Right now I draw a book for Image Comics called Thrilling Adventure Hour that's based on the podcast, The Thrilling Adventure Hour, if anybody knows who that is. And I do the Beyond Belief stories. I adapt those into comics. And then as a writer, I write a book called Mythic for Image Comics as well with artist John McCrae. And that's sort of a weird, boy, I don't know how to describe it. It's sort of what if heaven had janitors, you know? So it's about sort of the world of magic and the world of, you know, strange gods.
Wow.
But there's like this maintenance crew that makes sure all that runs smoothly. And it's about that maintenance crew.
What are you most excited about reading right now? What are the titles that get you going?
Oh, there are a ton of great books out right now. I think probably Image Comics is not just because I work there, but Image Comics is sort of like this great, you know, at the forefront of all these cool new voices in comics. And probably the best, I think everyone sort of generally recognizes that Saga is the best new book out right now, and that's written by Brian K. Vaughan. And another book I really love called Southern Bastards, which is written by Jason Aaron, who's a friend of mine, and drawn by Jason Latour, another friend of mine. But they're both – those guys are both huge stars in mainstream comics. But they went off to Image to do their sort of redneck revenge comic that they love so well called Southern Bastards.
Are you still surprised by things you see in comics? I mean, this – it seems like just we're continuing to expand and expand.
Yeah, it's really cool because, you know, like I said, superheroes dominated for so long. But now I think the tastes of the – not only the comic book reading populace, but – the culture at large is more accepting of comics that just want to go off and do their own thing. And yeah, every time you walk into a comic book store, you're going to find something new or something strange, hopefully strange, you know.
How do you feel about the – I know that you were partially involved in Ant-Man, which came out during the summer, now out on DVD. But how do you feel about how big Avengers have become in the movies right
now? It's really like surreal for me because, yeah, when I was – the idea that we'd ever see a superhero on screen was like such a strange thing to us. And to see everybody into those, like to see, like I said, the idea that like my great aunt knows who Thanos is now is weird to me. It nobody should know that. Like that all that stuff that used to be just ours is now belongs to the world at large. And, you know, it's strange, but it's also beautiful.
Is there any part of you that's like, oh, come on,
yeah,
that's mine?
I always want to say, you weren't here for the you know, the real struggle.
Right,
you.
Right.
You're just here for Robert Downey Jr.
Phil Hester, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you
thank
on the
you.
Show. And Phil Hester will be part of the first Cedar Rapids Comic Con, which is coming up in February 6th in Cedar Rapids, and also Ant-Man. You were involved in that. That's out on DVD now, so we can – and we were just talking about all of the great work you're doing. So there's a lot of Phil Hester out there. Phil Hester
Too
is
much.
A comic book artist and writer who lives in North English. This is Talk of Iowa.